This is East End Inc. Tonight we present cartoonist, playwright, and graphic novelist Jules Pfeiffer. In his latest graphic novel, The Ghost Script, Pfeiffer plunges us into the blousy, boozy world of blacklist Hollywood circa 1953. It's the final installment of a trilogy. Jules Pfeiffer spoke about the book at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in July 2018.
The Kill My Mother trilogy, this is the final volume, was never meant to be political. It was dreamed up as an old man's homage to the noir fiction and films of my boyhood, drawn in a style based on the works of the two cartoonists who were my adventure strip deities, Milton Caniff and Will Eisner. Milton Caniff did Terry and the Pirates when I was a kid, and really a kid, and later did Steve Canyon. And Will Eisner did The Spirit, which has become rather legendary in the last several decades. Nonetheless, by the middle of book two, Cousin Joseph, it became clear that I had tricked myself into writing about that time nearly 70 years ago, when my Bronx boy left-wing leanings fixed on the Hollywood blacklist, and I found myself shaped as a political being from that time to this. A week or so after I was discharged from the Army in 1953, I went down to Foley Square in downtown Manhattan to hear Jerome Robbins testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. From his fancy free ballet to his Broadway musicals On the Town and West Side Story, Robbins had revitalized theater and dance. The committee's chair, a schmuck named Clyde Doyle, the committee chair swore him in and asked what he did for a living. Robbins answered that he was a director and a choreographer. This last term had not yet entered common parlance, and Robbins was asked to explain what in the world it meant. But first, every committee member took his turn mispronouncing it for the folks listening on TV, on radio, back home in real America. Thus, indicating to the voters who counted that they were uncontaminated by this fairy New York City word. When Robbins finally testified and named names, which was the whole point of being there, Clyde Doyle, the chairman, said, "Mr. Robbins, we thank you for your loyal testimony here. My wife and I have tickets to the show, The King and I, which I understand you choreographers, and I know we will enjoy the show that much more because of your patriotic testimony." And Jerry Robbins looked down and said, "Thank you, Mr. Chairman." His humiliation was awful for him and so satisfying for the schmucks on the committee. Not long after, I attended a memorial service in Brooklyn for the blacklisted actor J. Edward Brownberg, one of the founders of the group theater. Midway through, another founding member playwright, Clifford Odets, made an unscheduled appearance. Odets gave a speech that had the audience on its feet, cheering. It was as if lost in Hollywood hackdom for years, he was reclaiming his title as our most important left-wing voice. With a poetic, oratorical sway of Waiting for Lefty, he denounced the committee for killing his old friend Joe. "But Joe's death would not go unavenged," said Odets. "Joe would be redeemed," said Odets. "The committee would be vanquished. American idealism would be restored." Odets, all of us were on our feet in that audience, screaming, "Odets is back," and tears in our eyes. "Odets is back." We wept. A week later, Odets appeared before the Un-American Activities Committee as a friendly witness. He named names, and when Odets was asked who had recruited him into the Communist Party, he came up with his first name, J. Edward Brumberg. Where am I? Am I going crazy? What kind of country am I living in? All these thoughts studded through my mind at that moment and for 70 years after. With the conclusion of this trilogy, I offer my last words on the subject. Old and valued friends were never far from my mind as I did this book. Blacklisted writers like Studs Terkel, Lillian Hellman, Walter Bernstein, Green Lardner Jr., and add to that a much admired acquaintance, Lee Grant. But I am not beyond personal weakness. As a distant cousin of Roy Cohn, Yes, he was my cousin. How could I not be so? There was a mixed assortment of thinks who, from time to time, I enjoyed myself with. Robert Rawson, Abe Burrows, Bud Schulberg, and Robbins, whom I knew slightly and liked. But more than all the others, I owe this book and the rage that went into it to Elia Kazan and Clifford Odets, who caused in me an undiluted rage, new to me in the 1950s, and almost as vivid today for the life-souring lessons they taught me about America and politics and personal betrayal. So, it's interesting how I started out doing one thing. I mean, it's not only interesting, it's also typical of how I work. I never know where anything is going to lead me, although there seems to be an unacknowledged storyline that I didn't tell myself, you know, and it emerges as I do the work. And so it was when I started Kill My Mother. I had no the first book of the trilogy. I had no thought of getting into politics or this or that. I was just trying to capture a period of time in my life. I loved noir, and I love the stories of the writers. I read everything by Dashiell Hammett I could get my hands on when I was a kid, and Raymond Chandler, and some of the others like William Irish, who also wrote under the name of Cornell Woolwich, and you know, just a whole bunch of these guys. And I just loved the material. And then when the films started coming out, John Huston's Maltese Falcon, Bogart, of course, The Big Sleep, with Raymond Chandler, Bogart, of course. They struck a note, and that not just hit me as in a permanent sense of what was important to me and what made sense to me in regard to the time, the sense of danger out there. We were at the end of World War II, the least hurt by of any of the allies in the war. We recovered the most quickly. We had this incredible invention of an overnight middle class that had never existed before. Everything was swimming in success, and as a result, we celebrated it with Hollywood musicals, and then immediately, aside from the musicals, switched to sci-fi fantasies where creatures from outer space were coming to get us, and to noir, where everything out there was betrayal and threatening. And it always made me wonder why this was so in tune with what we wanted and what we needed at the time. And I was fascinated at how that spirit of noir, whether in the stories or in particular the movies, so took us over. Let me read you something from the book here that deals with this. Archie Goldman, my detective, my private eye, is visiting a man named Murchison, an old man. He's on a mission, Archie is. And he's taken up to the top floor of a mansion and discovers on the top floor of a mansion a greenhouse. And the greenhouse is a replica of the greenhouse, for those of you who remember the picture, The Big Sleep, or the story, it's that greenhouse. And the old man inside the greenhouse says, "You have read Raymond Chandler. Since you are a private detective, I take it that you are familiar with The Big Sleep." And then he starts talking about the effect of movies on him, this old man. And that begins the trajectory of the book. And then he tells, his name is Murchison, and he's a key figure in the book. He's in his 80s. He's a key figure in the blacklist. He's a one-man clearinghouse for people who are blacklisted. He says to Archie, "Please hear me out. This used to be a beautiful country. Then they took it away from us. They called it the New Deal. They said they were going to end the Depression. Instead, they ended America. They shackled us with rules, thousands of regulations, when a farmer could plant, where or when he could plant it. If he didn't follow the rules, the farmer was fined or went to jail or lost his farm. We lost our freedom. Instead, they gave us unions. In a country that built the railroad and mined coal and silver and milled steel and manufactured automobiles, free men laboring around the clock, free men who didn't care as long as they got the job done. These men who, through the sweat of their brow, brick by brick, rail by rail, gave us the American dream. Then the socialists took over, and as the night follows the day, they legislated it away. They sold us into the slavery of forms and schedules and paperwork. How old are you? And Archie says, 42. And the old man says, you have never seen America. And that kind of sets the polarity in this book between what one element, which is very much in power today, although it had nothing to do with the book when I wrote it, that it was all about repealing the New Deal, getting back to the, when America, make America great again is really make America what it was before there was a New Deal. Now, all of that was done before Donald Trump was even on the scene, so I've just been lucky in America's disaster that it works out with my publishing schedule. But movies are a big deal in this, and talk about movies. So I have one of my favorite scenes, which I'll read you. It always fascinated me about Hollywood when I was a kid. First of all, the miseducation, at least the public school miseducation in the 30s and 40s of American kids. One of the things that we were taught about in PS 77 in the Bronx was the one thing you should know is that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. The Civil War, and if you thought it had something to do with slavery, you were very much mistaken. It was all about markets and one thing and another, but certainly not slavery. That the miseducation, the indoctrination that was forced as public education, is what made me run from schools all my life. And but it also formed, and I saw so much of that in the movies I saw and loved as a kid. I loved Westerns. But it always fascinated me how in Westerns, the good guys were always Southerners and Confederates, and the bad guys were always Yankees. So I put into this story an ex-commie producer, now for years blacklisted, now making his living as a waiter. His name is Ackerman, and he meets my hero Archie Goldman one night, and over drinks, he makes Archie buy him drinks as he tells his story. The chapter is called Ackerman's Complaint. Ackerman says, I was never as big as I made out, but I made out. Westerns. Back in my day, Westerns were shot under Confederate rules. Southerners were the good guys. Yankees were land grabbers. Rustlers, card sharps. Like as if the South won the Civil War. That's what the market wanted. That's what big picture producers like me gave him. Okay, now the naked truth. I was a member of the party. The party ordained us to start making progressive westerns. Of no good southern ranchers versus easygoing Yankee cowboys. Noble Indians versus genocidal cavalry. And Negroes. I was ordered to make them decent and brave, not cowards and chicken thieves, which was how they were cast under Confederate rules. So I went progressive. I made Thunder on the Mesa. I made Lynching and Laramie, Yankee heroes, Confederate villains, both flops. I'm losing a shitload of money, but still, the party denounces me for my faint-hearted liberalism. Then one day, I get a phone call. Voice on the other end says, sounds a little foreign, calls himself Cousin Joseph. Cousin Joseph is after me to go back to pro-American Western. By that he means Confederate rules, but he's a step up from the party. This Cousin Joseph, he offers me money. Every 3 weeks, like clockwork, a payment arrives in a music box delivered by some big hooligan named Hannigan. This is Sam Hannigan, who was the hero of the second book, Cousin Joseph. Sam Hannigan, scary son of a bitch. So I had to make Cousin Joseph happy, but I wasn't really ready to defy the party. So I tried to please them both. I made Quantrill's justice for Cousin Joseph. I made the saga of Sitting Bull for the party. I labeled both pictures adult westerns. They died at the box office. Audiences bitched that they couldn't tell the good guys from the bad guys. Practically overnight, my financing dried up. The day after I declared bankruptcy, I was expelled from the party. Not another dime from Cousin Joseph, who dropped out of sight. Me too. By this time, there's no love lost between me and my former comrade. But I still got some self-respect. I refused to name names before the Un-American Activities Committee. But I was so unimportant, they didn't bother to cite me for contempt. So I'm broke, and I wait tables. I had to be an ex-communist to have my first working-class experience.
This is East End, Inc. on WPKN Radio. We're listening to cartoonist and playwright Jules Pfeiffer talking about his latest graphic novel, The Ghost Script.
So this is my way all through this book of catching up culturally with all of the things that bugged me from the time I was in my teens and a fan of these movies and at the same, you know, and loving these movies and at the same time horrified by what the message, the propaganda that they all had. So in a way that this book became a kind of cultural and political catching up for me. And I just went from one thing I was passionate about as a young man to another thing I was passionate about, one after another, and I found a way of making it all part of a plot. All of these works that I do are me catching up to my own thoughts over the years that were never articulated officially in print, and finding a way, or hoping to find a way, to make them part of a story. And of course, it has to be entertaining and it has to be funny. I mean, that what I love about the form of the graphic novel that I came upon very late, simply because of age, I was no longer able to do theater because I'm deaf and I can't hear my own words. And because I was out here and out of the city where, you know, so I couldn't function as I normally did when I lived in the city. So I had to find a way of expressing myself, of telling my stories that I hadn't done before. And I just stumbled on this graphic novel form. I mean, a lot of people were already doing it, and some people I thought were doing incredible work. A lot of the people who started doing these books were originally influenced by me. And as they went on and did further and further experimental stuff, I became their student. And I began to learn how to do it from them. And I felt great joy at this whole round robin form of learning. And because I was in my 80s by that time, and I thought it was terrific to figure out a whole new craft I had never done before. 100 years earlier, I had worked with Will Eisner on his innovative strip, The Spirit. But I never knew how to draw in that realistic style of his. I was no good. I mean, Eisner quite properly was always condescending to me because he thought I was mostly pretty crappy at the job I was doing for him. Because I couldn't draw in that realistic style, I couldn't use a brush, which will always be. And what had happened in the intervening years is pens and brush pens developed that allowed me to draw in the way that I had to, where I wasn't crippled by my inability to use the brush the way other cartoonists did. I didn't need to have that ability. So I began to work freely and with these brush pens that allowed me to work as if I were working in pencil, which was what I loved most when I was young. And as I drew these things, I realized that there was a freedom, as you can see, in the line and in the work. And more, what I tried to do in terms of the layout, how I illustrated it, is not just to simply tell the story that was set in type that I wrote beforehand, all typed up and transferred. but to try to make it a living operation, that when I took the typed manuscript and started transferring it to layouts before I did the page, I moved the images around. I did this, I did that. I tried to think, whose point of view is this? Who's talking? Do I show the person talking? Do I show the person listening? Do I show them both? What are they doing? And suddenly I realized I was shooting a movie, and that this was a storyboard kind, the preparation for a movie. And I was thinking like a director. And as a director, who always throws out the script by the screenwriter, I was throwing out my own script, my own type words, and rewriting them to fit the image on the page as I imagined the page. And so it became this living thing that kept going on and changing, and I had to keep catching up with it. And then I saw that the kind of art I was doing and wanted to do had a life to it and an energy to it. And I realized that I wanted that, although everything I write takes place in the long ago past, because that's all I know about. I don't know anything about today, including the language used. So I have to deal with the past, but I wanted to take the past and put it on the page as if it were coming at the reader. It was assaulting the reader. I wanted the drawings to look as if they were leaping off the page. And as if, as you turn from one page to another, the ink had barely dried before you turned the page. And to give it a life, and so that even though this took place, this book particularly, in 1953, it has a sense of immediacy as you read it, as if it just happened. The way when I wrote for the theater, I wanted to drag the audience on stage with the actors and have them be in the scene, involve them so that they connected to, they became part of the play. Anybody who writes plays, Joan has just written a wonderful play, knows that you don't know what you're watching in the play until the audience is there and begins to react, and the audience is part of the play. The audience is in the cast. And when it's working well, it's an extraordinary experience. It's a very live experience. So I wanted to get that version of it, or whatever version close to that I could, in these books, in this new form that I was working in, because theater was now denied me.
We're listening to Jules Pfeiffer talking about his graphic novel, The Ghost Script. Pfeiffer replied to a question, why was there no Broadway blacklist?
Hollywood had a blacklist, and so you had to name names. Broadway didn't have a blacklist, and Kazan, no one was more successful as stage director than Kazan. Clifford Odets, before Arthur Miller came along, was the most famous American playwright. And they had, and after he was in Hollywood, Odets continued to write some plays, and he had written some very successful plays. But once these guys got Hollywood money and Hollywood success and Hollywood fame, the other stuff stopped meaning that much. So it wasn't about preserving their integrity. It was preserving, they wanted the Academy Award. They wanted that adoration. They wanted, same thing with Robbins. Robbins wanted, they were about to do West Side Story as a film. He didn't want to be blacklisted from the movie from the show he created. So in order to direct at least the choreography of West Side Story, name names. I think it was the last picture he did. It was a period of such shame and such complicity, and the people who suffered from it, very few of them actually came back to on a level that made their lives what it was before that. And it lasted a very, very long time. In 1953, where I placed this book, simply because the timing is right for me getting out of the Army, the blacklist had been in place since, I don't know, 46, 47.
This is East End Inc. We heard cartoonist and playwright Jules Pfeiffer talking about his latest graphic novel, The Ghost Script, published in 2018 by W.W. Norton. Other books in the series are Kill My Mother and Cousin Joseph, a compilation of the cartoonist's work, Out of Line, The Art of Jules Pfeiffer, was published by Harry Abrams in 2015. Some free literary events at Canyo's Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, include poet Grace Shulman reading from her new memoir, Strange Paradise, Portrait of a Marriage, on Saturday, September 29th at 5 p.m. Poets Salim Abdul Khalik and Sarah Azara read from recent work on Friday, October 5th at 6 p.m. And rock journalist sociologist Donna Gaines reads Why the Ramones Matter on Saturday, October 13th at 5 p.m. More events are listed at canyosbooks.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Zoker and Marianne Calendro. This is Hazel Carr.